Today I'm joined by Dean, a writer and researcher who has authored the three-part NORAD papers and other articles of interest to 9/11 researchers, and his writing can be accessed at dnotus.org. Thank you for joining me today on the Corbett Report.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
No problem. All right, Dean, firstly, for listeners who might not be familiar with your work, can you introduce yourself, your work, and your website?
Well, let me start when I became interested in the subject of 9/11, and that was several months after the attack, when the Colleen Riley memo came out. Colleen Riley memo was a memo that she wrote to the FBI headquarters here in D.C., taking them to task for what seemed to be the sabotage of a search warrant concerning Sally, the individual who the FBI says is the 20th hijacker. Now, the Minneapolis field office for which Colleen Riley was chief legal counsel for, had requested the David Fresca, who was in charge of the investigation, who would sign off on the warrant for searching Sally's computer. What he did is he sabotaged that warrant. He told the Minneapolis field office that they could not have a search warrant because of the law that prevented FBI intelligence from making up ongoing criminal investigations. But you see, that situation only applied to U.S. persons, and Sally, of course, was not a U.S. person. He's here on a visa. If you're a citizen or you are a person holding a green card, then a search warrant would have been problematic for the FBI. But Fresca said it was even problematic for Sally, and so he therefore declined to provide a search warrant. And as we know that after the 9/11 attacks, they did search Sally's computer. He was arrested, his computer was searched, and they found the plans for the 9/11 attack on his computer. Of course, if Fresca had signed that search warrant as he should have under the law originally, 9/11 attacks would have been averted. So this is one of the first things that got me interested in 9/11. Then as I did a little bit more research, I found out about Sybil Edmonds, who was a translator for the FBI field office here in D.C., and her allegations that by April of 2001, her field office had already obtained information from sources in the Middle East about the 9/11 attack, the targets, how they were to be attacked, etc., very detailed specifics on the attacks, and this was known by the FBI by April of 2001. Then I heard about David Schiffer, the individual that suggested that Clinton be impeached. He was the chief counsel for the investigation, the House investigation into whether or not to impeach Clinton, and six weeks before the attack, three FBI agents came to him and informed him of the attack. The exact nature of the attack, what the day was, the target. And they said, can you do anything to avert them? Because, you know, we've tried all we can do and just nobody wants to listen. So he took out his phone book and started making telephone calls to contacts in Washington, D.C., but no one would return his phone call. So those are several of the things that first got me interested in 9/11. And of course, I was constantly talking to my family here about 9/11, and my cousin said, "Well, why don't you start up a website? I can assist you." He's more computer savvy, and so back in May, he set up the website for me, and I started publishing articles with a lot of the information I'd gleaned, say, over the past 6 or so years on 9/11.
I see. Well, obviously, a lot of research has gone into your work, and I think the idea of Defense Intelligence Agency, the FBI, other intelligence branches of the U.S. government sabotaging their own agents' investigations got a lot of people interested in 9/11 truth. So how did you go from that to an interest in NORAD's lack of response on the morning of 9/11?
NORAD was of interest, of course, because I seem to remember back in the 70s and 80s that NORAD also watched within America as opposed to outside of America, and of course including Canada. The NORAD treaty is a treaty that covers, of course, both Canada and the United States. And so I reasoned to myself that, well, if this is true, if my memory serves me well, then there must be articles on the internet that would inform us of that fact that NORAD indeed watched aircraft within and outside the United States, because of course during the 9/11 Commission hearing, General Richard Myers, who at the time was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, made the following statement to then Minister in response to a question that the Minister gave him on NORAD's failure to anticipate the attack. Now, this is General Richard Myers' statement. He said, quote, "I can't answer the hypothetical. It's the way that we were directed to posture, looking outward," end quote. Now, interesting, looking outward, is that it? So I went back in the internet and did some research, and lo and behold, I found a whole slew of articles that actually contradicted General Richard Myers, and saying that NORAD, as well as looking outward for air attacks, also look within the nation for any threat.
Well, tell us a little bit more about that, what you uncovered specifically regarding that information about an inward-looking function of NORAD.
Well, let me give you a few quotes then. My research led me to a 1994 General Accounting Office report on NORAD. Now, of course, when I did my research on the internet on NORAD, I was looking for articles published or posted before September 11, 2001. So all the articles I'm now going to quote you all come from the 1990s, before 1995, all the way up to 1999. And this is from the General Accounting Office 1994 report, and it says, quote, "NORAD defines air sovereignty as providing surveillance and control of the territorial airspace, which includes intercepting and destroying uncontrollable air objects, tracking hijacked aircraft, assisting aircraft in distress, escorting communist civil aircraft, and intercepting suspect aircraft, including counter-drug operations and peacetime military intercepts." So here we have the GAO, 1994, saying that NORAD's air sovereignty mission is surveillance and control of the territorial airspace of the United States and, of course, Canada. So that's within the United States and within Canada. A little bit more research, and I found that in actuality, NORAD's air sovereignty mission, which just quoted, is actually their first mission. They have actually three missions. NORAD's first responsibility is to provide surveillance and control of the airspace covering North America. The second part of NORAD's mission is to provide the national command authorities with tactical warning and attack assessment of an airspace attack against North America. And NORAD's third responsibility is to provide an appropriate response to any form of an attack. So, as we see, since 1958, like what General Meyer said at the during his testimony at the 9/11 Commission, NORAD has had three missions or three responsibilities. Its first being its air sovereignty mission, which is, of course, as GAO defined, surveillance and control of the territorial airspace. That's the airspace, of course, over any country, and there'll be airspace, of course, over America or over Canada. And we then have some other interesting quotes. One that comes from Canada from 1998. It comes from the Department of National Defense, of all places, which, of course, is the counterpart to our Pentagon. And it was written by Major Francois Malot. Quote, in 1998, Canada possesses the ability to detect, identify, and if necessary, intercept aircraft over Canadian territory. The Canadianization of NORAD operations over Canada is complete, though we still rely heavily on the Americans for the integrated tactical warning and attack assessment and mutual defense. Get this. We have successfully transitioned on at least one of the three core functions of NORAD. Now, back in 1998, this article written in 1998 is telling us that finally Canada has at least managed to successfully transition on at least one of the three core functions of NORAD, which of course is surveillance and control. And Major Malot says that now Canada, without the assistance of America, which she needed before 1998, without the assistance of America, they can detect, identify, and, if necessary, intercept aircraft over Canadian territory. Of course, here in the United States, the Americans have been doing that since at least 1958, when NORAD was first created. Another interesting quote comes from the National Guard Association of the United States, and this is published in September 1997. And what makes this very interesting is that the National Guard Association is, of course, is an umbrella organization covering the Army National Guard and the Air National Guard, and it is the Air National Guard are the chaps and gals that actually monitor our NORAD radar sites and fly our NORAD interceptors if there's a need to intercept errant aircraft. So, what does the National Guard Association article say about NORAD? It says the following, quote, aircraft flying over our airspace are monitored 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. Much of the identifying process is done by hand. Flight plans from the Federal Aviation Administration are compiled in logs and have to be manually searched to identify aircraft. Unlike current operating procedures, the new system will mean fewer manual inquiries and phone contact with FAA officials about commercial aircraft. The FAA flight plan is now hooked up by a computer with new RSAOCs, so operators can get this now. Easily track friendly aircraft through our airspace without having to get someone on the phone to thumb through written logs of flight plans. So here we have in 1997 the National Guard Association of the United States saying that aircraft flying over our airspace are monitored 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And then it goes on to explain the process of how they monitor aircraft. This article was actually about a new operating system that NORAD was implementing. It was planning on hooking up their monitors with the FAA monitor so they could more clearly, they could immediately identify an aircraft on their monitor as opposed to going into logbooks that they would get from the FAA every morning. From those logbooks, that is how they would identify aircraft that they were watching on their monitors flying through our airspace.
And listeners to my podcast will know that the researcher, the researcher who came out with the information that, in fact, a company called PTEC was running the enterprise architecture software that was dealing with the interoperability of FAA and NORAD on the morning of 9/11. And this,
Indira Singh.
Yes, thank you. Indira Singh, exactly. And her information is startling because, of course, PTEC leads back to a number of terrorist agencies, which are also handled by the CIA and other intelligence agencies. So there's definitely an incredible morass of information to delve into there. But for the moment, stick...
No.
Oh, please, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Those interested in Indira Singh, I also have an article that covers her. It's called, let me see, the title is, let me get back, go back home. Title is, it was published, it was posted July 9th, 08, and it's called, No, Not That Entwistle, Neil Entwistle. And in there you'll find a discussion of Indira Singh and what she found out about PTEC.
Absolutely, some incredibly vital information for 9/11 researchers. But sticking with the NORAD theme, clearly the idea that NORAD was positioned only in an outward posture and thus couldn't possibly be capable of handling the attacks of 9/11 is a fraud, and you've uncovered that quite well, I think, with all of those documents preceding 9/11. So what then does that make of Richard Meyer's testimony?
Oh, he committed perjury, and it's a case of... If it went to trial, and the jury was giving me evidence, they would convict. Now, if he had only, I don't mean only, but if he had never have been in command of one agency before he became chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, maybe the jury would say, "Oh, well, he was fuzzy and." Yes, even though he's chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he should have known that NORAD looked within and outward. But we'll give him a pass on this. However, because Richard Myers was also in, was also the commander-in-chief of a certain agency before he became chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the jury would, of course, convict on perjury. And what agency is that, that he was commander-in-chief of before he became chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff? Ah, well, from August 1998 to February 2000, General Richard Myers was also commander-in-chief, was commander-in-chief of, guess what?
NORAD?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, of course, if he went to trial, he would be, of course, convicted of perjury. No jury would buy that, of course, so well. I forgot, or I was fuzzy, or I wasn't feeling well that morning when I gave my testimony, and that's why I said what I said. They would have immediately convicted.
Well, certainly his background would lead to that, but you'll have to fill me in on one finer detail there. I know that some of the witnesses at the 9/11 Commission weren't actually sworn in for their testimony. Was Richard Myers sworn in before he gave his testimony?
They were sworn in, Ian Eberhardt. Yeah, there are several pictures there you can see with their, I think their hands up being sworn in.
So again, this is some bombshell information. It hasn't really been covered by many 9/11 researchers so far. Why do you think that is?
I'm not sure. I think David Ray Griffin has concentrated his research on what NORAD does when they are notified by the FAA, and that's where he can find his research. And, of course, great research that is. And I don't know. I've questioned that myself, why nobody else had, I'm sure, actually, there are many people out there. I've gotten emails, people who have done research on this, but they've never posted it. They say that they haven't published it. They haven't solicited other people to look at it. I am the first one I'm the first one to research this. I don't know why I had such an interest of researching NORAD as opposed to other areas of 9/11 truth. Maybe it's because other areas of 9/11 truth were pretty much saturated with researchers. The World Trade Center, the anomalies there. Again, you have lots of analysis. You have Professor Jones, Kevin Rhine, many researchers looking into that. So maybe that's it. I stuck with NORAD because so few. But I really can't answer why it's only one person who's delved into what were NORAD's missions before 9/11. Was NORAD looking within and without, or was she just looking outside for threats?
Well, I do thank you for bringing this to our attention, but what do you say? I think the obvious response of people who are incredulous at this type of information would be to say that this only shows that NORAD, in retrospect, was trying to cover up for their own ineptness on the morning of 9/11 rather than indicating some type of, dread the word, conspiracy. How would you respond to that? And I'm thinking in particular of an article you wrote about Payne Stewart's Learjet crash in 1999 that might have an indication that perhaps NORAD had already been doctoring some information related to intercepts.
Oh, incompetence. It would involve the incompetence of many pairs of eyes on the morning of 9/11. And again, you'd want there if it were you know, incompetence, where's the investigation? But no, military organizations are trained, systematically trained, to perform their tasks. And when you have on one morning four errant aircraft flying over our airspace, and NORAD is errant in intercepting them. Now, as a matter of fact, it's the 9/11 Commission's final report that pretty much clears NORAD of any major culpability. The blame actually is focused in the final report on the FAA. FAA is blamed for not notifying NORAD on the first aircraft, Flight 11, for 23 minutes. It isn't notified. The FAA don't notify NORAD until, 9 minutes before the plane impact. The second plane, Flight 175, NORAD isn't informed about that plane until the very same minute it impacts the building at the South Building at 903. NORAD isn't informed about the Pentagon Flight 77 flight until after it crashes, and it isn't informed about Flight 93 until after it crashes at 10:03 in the morning. So the 9/11 Commission actually puts the blame to the FAA. But there is something else here that nobody has talked about, and this is going to be a subject of a new article that cropped into my mind a few days ago, is that David Ray Griffin's research, of course, deals with what does NORAD do when they're called by the FAA? And that's David Ray Griffin's research area. And, of course, reading the NORAD, doing the research for NORAD, and especially the National Guard Association article that I quoted a few minutes to you from 1997, and how NORAD actually identified aircraft that they were tracking through our airspace back in those days, it suddenly occurred to me that the article, that National Guard Association article, also provided another area of research that has been neglected on NORAD, and that is that NORAD radar operators just don't sit staring at their consoles like wallflowers. As the National Guard Association article says, they actually initiate phone contact with FAA to find out the identity of aircraft that they are tracking through our airspace. And let me see if I can find a quote here for you. There will be a learning curve for air guard operators, but the system that Littman touts as faster and better will ultimately make their job easier. Unlike current operating procedures, the new system, and this is a new computer system that Littman Corporation was designing for NORAD, the new system will mean fewer manual inquiries and phone contact with FAA officials about commercial aircraft. The FAA flight plan is now hooked up via computer with the new RSAOCs, so operators can easily track friendly aircraft through our airspace without having to get someone on the phone or thumb through written logbooks of flight plans. So here we see that back in 1997, when this article was written, in order to identify aircraft that the NORAD radar operators were watching on their screen flying through our airspace, they would either have to do one of two things. Go to the FAA log that they would get every morning and thumb through those to identify that aircraft that they see on their radar screen. And by identifying that aircraft, they would know then that that aircraft is on the correct flight plan, or maybe it isn't on the correct flight plan. Or they could call the FAA and find out. So here we, this article, we have NORAD contacting FAA, not waiting to be contacted by the FAA. So this is another area of research, and another, I'm going to write up another article on NORAD and this latest topic that actually is NORAD that also initiates contact with the FAA. So on the morning of 9/11, contrary to what the 9/11 Commission left out, there's nothing in there about, well, what did NORAD do on the morning of 9/11? Because within 5 minutes, at the very most, if they had not been contacted by the FAA, according to this article here back in 1997, they would have contacted the FAA and say, what's going on? There's an aircraft that's out of its flight path. Flight 11 has just veered off its flight path. Can you tell us what's going on there? And of course, the FAA operator would have told NORAD, yeah, we're watching it too. Can you send up some jets and see what's going on? But of course, as we know, on the morning of 9/11, for the first plane, FAA, we're told by the 9/11 Commission, the FAA did not notify NORAD for 23 minutes. Now, NORAD operators are not going to sit in their chairs for 23 minutes watching an aircraft on their monitor screen way off course and do nothing. According to this article back in 1997, they actually initiate phone contact with the FAA. And then again, of course, that morning we had three other aircraft that the FAA failed to notify NORD about until after they had crashed flight 175. Again, FAA, we are told by the 9/11 Commission, didn't notify NORD until the exact minute that it crashed, 9:03. The third aircraft, flight 77, the way into the Pentagon, we are told that NORD wasn't notified until after it crashed into the Pentagon at 9:38. The fourth aircraft, we are told that flight 93 was crashed in Pennsylvania. Well, NORAD, we are told by 9/11 Commission, NORAD wasn't informed by the FAA that that plane had been hijacked until after it crashed at 9:03. Well, there's something wrong there, because NORAD operators would have been contacting FAA, ATC, long before those planes had ever crashed. And they would have been inquiring, what's going on? What's happening? Why is such and such a flight deviating? And of course, FAA operators would have been doing what they've been doing ever since 1958, when such incidents happened. They would have been requesting an intercept to find out what's going on.
Absolutely. And on the subject of the contact between FAA and NORAD, of course, Vanity Fair came out with that famous article, The NORAD Tapes, which documented a number of hours of conversation that had been recorded in the NORAD control room in the Northeast Air Defense Sector that morning. And of course, one of the things that the article points out is that, quote, "Is this real world or exercise?" is heard nearly verbatim over and over on the tapes as troops funnel onto the ops floor and are briefed about the hijacking. And of course, end quote. And of course, that obviously indicates that there were a number of drills and exercises going on that morning, which brings us into a whole different realm of 9/11 NORAD intercept research. What has your research uncovered about the drills that were going on that morning that might have interfered with NORAD's response?
Well, yeah, they twice a year, NORAD has a war game that they practice. On the West Coast, they have it twice a year. They have it on the West Coast during spring, and on the in the East Coast during the fall. And then the morning of 9/11, they were into the second day of their fall drill. Coincidentally enough, now, when these drills take place, they're supposed to, standard operating procedure, they're supposed to have aircraft running hot on the ground with the pilot in close proximity, so that in case anybody takes advantage of our war game going on that week, NORAD can respond even quicker than on those days when war games aren't in progress. So those war games should have assisted our response, but as we see on 9/11, they didn't seem to do much good at all, because, according to 9/11 Commission, NORAD wasn't notified about the speed of the aircraft until after they had crashed, and wasn't informed about the first aircraft until 9 minutes before it slammed into the North Tower. So it will be interesting to know the details of why there was such a slow response, especially on a day when there were these war games going on, and that we know from history that when you do have war games going on, the operators, of course, air control operators, the NORAD operators, all go to work that day knowing that there's going to be drills being conducted, that they know that they know to be ready for these drills. They are ready. There are planes on the tarmac ready to go just in case. So everybody is very prepared for the scenario that takes place that day. That week, as a matter of fact. And on 9/11, we have an four instances, all within the period of, within a two-hour period, where aircraft are just flying willy-nilly over nuclear power plants, over army bases, and again, over another restricted area, southern Manhattan. That's a no-fly zone. And nothing happened. These aircraft just, it seemed that the FAA and NORAD operators were just transfixed on their monitor screen, glazed in a trance.
And something that might help explain that actually comes from the end of that paragraph I was reading from the NORAD tapes from Vanity Fair. That says, quote, almost everyone in the room first assumes the phone call is from the simulations team on hand to send inputs, simulated scenarios, into play for the day's training exercises, end quote. I mean, that's a startling insight into the way these games are actually played out, so that the operators themselves don't know what is actually in the real world and what is in the exercise, and they have to constantly confirm if these planes are actually real or if they're just these inputs that are being put on their screen.
Right. Well, once that first airplane was determined to have been hijacked, now in Flight 11, once it was determined that it was hijacked, and that was 11. That was 8:21. It had been determined to have been hijacked. It was also flying way askew of its flight plan. So by 8:21, NORAD operators saw this this plane going askew of its flight plan. So they at 8:21 they would have been contacting the FAA. Of course, the FAA should have been contacting NORAD when first they realized that this aircraft was hijacked. And when that happened, the war game scenarios would have been immediately canceled, and there would have been no more false flips on those radar screens, no matter where they came from: PTEC, Cheney, regular NORAD simulators. No matter where these blips came from, the blips should have stopped. But it seems that they didn't stop. They kept reappearing on the monitor screen, which tells us that there was sabotage going on.
Absolutely, and that's an incredibly important point. It's a point that Webster Tarpley has addressed in some of his talks, and I believe that it's his assertion that at one point there were up to 27 possible hijacked jets on the NORAD radar that morning.
Yeah. Well, they should have been, the fact that they're still on there is proof of sabotage. They immediately, once that first airplane was determined to have been hijacked, the war game scenario would have been called off. That would have been an automatic, response, and jets would have been in the air, flying faster than Flight 11, the first airplane that morning, the supposedly hijacked. And they would have been heading towards that aircraft or whatever that aircraft was, and intercepted it and done what they would have had to have done in normal standard operating procedure, which is you rock your wings to get the pilot's attention. If the pilot refuses to pay attention, then you can fire tracer, fire bullets across the plane. And if that fails, you can go to the ultimate deadly last resort and fire missiles to take it down. And that comes from NORAD itself.
Yes, and of course, the actual protocol dealing with how to shoot down or how to get authority to shoot down hijacked aircraft over U.S. airspace was changed mysteriously 2 months prior to 9/11, so that it had to go through Donald Rumsfeld, who was not contactable during the entire hijacking scenario of 9/11, which is a whole other field of research. But let's just...
Right, and that's right. David Ray Griffin has covered that well, and he's done the best job on that, because he's also pointed out that while that is true for hijacked aircraft, we also have to remember on the morning of 9/11, we didn't just have a case of hijacked aircraft. We had also a case of in-flight emergency. And for in-flight emergencies or emergency aircraft which go off their flight plan, big difference. If it's a hijacked aircraft, this new rule applies. But when an aircraft becomes an in-flight emergency, the old rule would still, of course, apply. And, of course, before these airplanes were known to have been hijacked, they were in-flight emergency, which means that the new regulation doesn't hold, because the new regulation says if it is an emergency, revert back to the old regulation, and then it tells you what the old regulation is. And when you go back and research the old regulation, it says that NORAD can intercept once they have FAA request permission to intercept. And you, under the old regulations, you don't need to contact Rumsfeld or anybody else. It's just the it's the way it was before. June 1, 2001. So yeah, David Ray Griffin made that point out very clear that in-flight emergencies, that's one protocol. Hijacking, that's another protocol, and the reason for that is because with in-flight emergencies, with planes going off their flight plan, these are now threats to other aircraft in the airspace. So NORAD and the FAA need to immediately take care of that business, need to immediately find out what's going on, because you are now a threat to other aircraft. Classically, with hijacked aircraft, these hijacked aircraft always maintain their flight plan. They didn't deviate. This is why there's for NORAD and the FAA, there's less anxiousness when it comes to hijacked aircraft, because up till 9/11, they always maintained their flight plan. That's why NORAD and the FAA could take a little bit more time with dealing with hijacked aircraft, because the experience was the hijackers let the pilot do the flying, the pilot stayed on course. If the pilot changed his course, the FAA saying you could change your course, even though it was a hijacked aircraft. FAA gave permission to clear the area, the airspace, so that you could change, etc. But with in-flight emergencies, of course, that's a different matter. The old rules still applied on the morning of 9/11.
Well, on the subject of shootdowns, I'm sure that you saw recently in the trial of Osama bin Laden's limousine driver. He was on trial, and one of the prosecutors in the trial repeated unquestioningly an assertion by Ayman al-Zawahiri that Flight 93 was in fact shot down by the U.S. Air Force.
Something was shot down over Somerset County, but whatever impacted the ground at the specific site of Shanksville that we were all shown was not Flight 93. That was identified as a missile. There's many witnesses who, especially one lady, Susan McElwain, saw the missile. It flew right over her car, right over the hood of her car, feet above her car, and it was onto the power lines, and then zoomed up into the air to clear a tree line that was in front of her, went over the trees, she then lost sight of it, and then she heard the explosion. That was the cruise missile. She says it was no bigger than the size of her car. She said it had short, stubby wings. And when the FBI came to her and said, Did you see the Boeing 757 that, can you describe the Boeing, the plane? And she described the plane to the FBI, and they said to her, oh, well, you don't know what a Boeing 757 looks like, do you? And she looked at them and said, don't be condescending to me. And the FBI didn't want to hear any more from her, and so they left. But, other eyewitnesses, I've heard that other eyewitnesses on the freeway or on the highway, on the road, saw the same thing. I can confirm that was told to me. But if you want confirmation from Susan McElwain and what she saw, well, of course, she's on YouTube. You can watch her testimony and what she described. Flew over the hood for a car onto the power line. And, of course, that wasn't a 757 that she saw. Now, the thing that crashed a few miles away, that is also interesting. There was an aircraft shot down because there is definitely engine debris several miles away from the Shanksville crash site, or not crash site, the Shanksville, I would say, missile strike, impact ground area there. And, exactly what aircraft that was I would like to know, because in one of my articles, it's plain to see, Flight 93 landed first at Cleveland Airport earlier that morning. Now, whether or not it took off again, and then it was shot out of the sky by our Air Force, I'm not sure. But I do know that Flight 93 landed at Cleveland Airport, and the reason that we are not hearing anything from the passengers of that flight is because when it landed at Cleveland Airport, its call letters was not Flight 93. Its call letters were other letters like Flight 87 or Flight 77, something like that. But Flight 93 did land at Cleveland Airport early that morning, before actually the first plane flew into the South Tower. And it's interesting to note that two of the aircraft that were involved in the attack, I think it's American Airlines, the two American Airlines aircraft, if I'm not mistaken, there are no records of them being taking off that day. Actually, I think it's the United Airlines. No records of them taking off that day at all. No records of them being on the tarmac, no records of them taxiing, no records of fuel, maintenance, nothing, nada, zero. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe one of those is actually Flight 93, but that would explain why there is no record of Flight 93, because Flight 93 did not take off from Cleveland. I mean, Flight 93 did not take off from, I think it was Boston Logan is where it took off from.
Well, there's no doubt that there are all sorts of things to be investigated regarding the flights themselves, including, of course, the passenger manifests that don't include the hijackers or the supposed hijackers. But let's step back for a moment. We've covered a lot of information so far today, Dean, and I'd just like to step back and put this into perspective for people. For people out there who have never really contemplated the scope of NORAD's failure on 9/11, tell us in your own words about the likelihood of 19 men with box cutters hijacking four jets and flying them around unmolested in the most heavily defended airspace in the world.
It's impossible. It's laughable. It's ludicrous that four aircraft. Number one, these individuals who were not the toughest looking, not the biggest, would commandeer these cockpits with pilots who were not larger than they were, and if the pilots would give up the cabin to individuals with short, very short, stubby knives. But the question is, how do these guys get those knives on there? Well, box cutters, I guess. There's other accounts that from the passengers that they had bombs. How do they get those on there? Which is an interesting question. But that's, 19, it defies fidelity to accept the official conspiracy theory that was put out. And then when you look at the PNAC document that came out the year before 9/11, where it says that in order for the American public to go along with the military spending that PNAC signers wanted to go along with the force projection in the Middle East, a military projection in the Middle East, that the PNAC document said that there was needed a cataclysmic and catalyzing event, quote, like a new Pearl Harbor, end quote. Now, this was written in September 2000, and then exactly 1 year later, when these guys actually then do take office in the Bush administration, well, we have a cataclysmic and catalyzing event, don't we, on 9/11? Well, four aircraft taking off and three of them flying into buildings, and one of them is shot down over Pennsylvania, although the one that's shot down over Pennsylvania, it crashes elsewhere. In Somerset County, it's not the one that crashes at the Shanksville crash site.
All right, a wealth of information to cover. But finally today, I'd just like to ask you, it is coming up to the 7th anniversary of 9/11 next week. And I wanted to ask your thoughts about what the 9/11 truth movement has managed to accomplish so far and what it hasn't managed to accomplish so far, where you think it's might be leading from here, and what the significance of an anniversary like the 7th anniversary has.
What I would like to see 9/11 truth is for 9/11 truth, individual 9/11 truth movement to run for government. I'd like to see you're going to need individuals with actual power, actual authority to implement change, because what we have now residing within the United States government, doesn't matter whether it's in the bureaucracy, it doesn't matter whether it's in the Congress, or within the legislative or the Senate, you have individuals, every member of Congress, every senator, they know what happened in 9/11. And they are complicit now in those attacks by failing to speak out. Even Cynthia McKinney was circumspect when she was a member of Congress several years back. And what we need is people who want the truth, who do speak out, running for office, and demanding investigation. And I personally don't see much happening until that happens. Until more people begin to realize what happened on 9/11. And 9/11 Truth Movement, of course, has opened the eyes of many individuals whose eyes wouldn't have been opened without the likes of David Griffin or Stephen Jones. But we also need people in office, and we need a real investigation. When we get somebody in office, we need a real investigation of what happened on that day, on why those failures really occurred. Otherwise, I don't see much happening. It's like the JFK assassination. We all know that that JFK was murdered by elements within the national security apparatus for reasons that are not altogether, for reasons that we can speculate on. We all know it. Nobody believes here in America, very few people here in America believe that, believe in the official conspiracy theory of JFK's assassination, that it was, Lee Harvey Oswald himself that committed the crime. They can all watch the videotapes of the Secret Service motorcade slowing down, JFK's own car slowing down after he's been shot. They can do the pictures of the Secret Service agents in the chase car behind him, just standing there, watching, actually looking right at JFK as JFK is struggling with his neck. And this is after the second shots rang out, and they're just standing there or sitting in their car watching him. So anybody who, of course, most people in America know that now that JFK was fascinated by elements within his own government. But what's happened since then? Nothing. So I'm very hopeful. I have hope, but there's something inside me that says until there are individuals here in America that get elected and speak out, very little is going to change. Very little is going to change. Which isn't to say that there aren't individuals in our government that do attempt to thwart these false flag attacks that do periodically break out. There are individuals in this government that are and have forestalled other false flag attacks in the United States since 9/11. But that might be that of course is hard work on their part. It might be a bit of something. It might be a matter of luck and hard work. That there are people inside our government, including the intelligence agencies and the military, that attempt to forestall false flag attacks. They weren't totally successful. They weren't successful at all in 9/11. As I mentioned, there were FBI who were trying to do something, but Ashcroft and the others didn't want anything, didn't want to hear about it. So I'm a little bit pessimistic, but always hopeful. I always have a glimmer of hope that something will transpire. Maybe something will come out, some new revelation will come out in the near future or not too distant future that will galvanize public support in a way that 9/11 truth couldn't have foreseen. So pessimistic, but always hopeful.
Well, there's one thing that's for certain, and that's that if there is to be a revelation or a breakthrough in 9/11 truth, it probably won't come descend from the heavens on a golden plate. It'll come from researchers like yourself doing the work in the trenches and digging up this information. So how can people access your work and find out about your articles?
You can go to my website, dnotice.org, and all the articles are there. I'll be, of course, doing a new article within the next 2 weeks on what NORAD would have been doing, what NORAD radar operators would have been doing in 9/11, instead of just waiting for the FAA to contact them and ask them, hey, can you assist us? My next article will be on NORAD in the years before 9/11, how NORAD operators would actually initiate contact with the FAA as opposed to just sitting there and doing nothing. So that'll be my next article. And dnotice.org, that's where you can find the NORAD papers as well as several other papers that caught my interest.
All right, Dean, let's leave it on that note. Thank you very much for joining me today on the Corbett Report.
Thank you for having me on, James.
Okay, excellent. I'll stop the recording at that point. And as I say, I will get this up to you. I will get this up on the website, and I'll send you the link, obviously, as soon as it is, probably in the next day or maybe 2 days.
Okay, great.
Okay, awesome. All right, again, I look forward to reading that article. So when it's up on your website, please email me a link to it.
Okay, great.
Okay. All right, thank you very much for joining me. I hope to talk to you again in the future.
Okay, thank you, James.
No problem. Talk to you later. Goodbye.